This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of our show, we remember writer Robertson Davies. He died last Saturday at the age of 82. Davies was one of Canada's most prominent writers. He grew up in small towns in Ontario, where his father published a group of newspapers. From 1942 to 62, Robertson Davies edited and published one of those papers. He's also worked as an actor and was the master of Massey College at the University of Toronto. His impressive body of work includes the novels What's Bred in the Bone, The Manticore, and Fifth Business, as well as anthologies collecting his speeches and magazine and newspaper writing. His novel The Cunning Man, which was published earlier this year, was described by several critics as one of Davies' most entertaining novels. It weaves together Davies' preoccupations with medicine, psychology, religion, and magic. I spoke to Davies in February, after it was published, and asked him about the meaning of the expression cunning man. He told me he first came across cunning men in Wales, where he used to go as a child on vacations with his father.
I discovered that there was always in every community somebody who was always called a wise woman or a cunning man. And a cunning man was somebody who was he might be a horse doctor. He might look after sick animals. He might give advice on difficult questions. He might help to find lost objects because, of course, he had a sort of in on the underworld, such as it was in those districts. And also, he would take spells off your animals if anybody had put a spell on them. And if you were able to manage it and talk to him tactfully, he might just put a spell on somebody else's animals for you. And this all, of course, required a fee. And that was what a cunning man was. He was a kind of village wizard.
Did you ever go to see a cunning man?
Oh, I saw several of them, yes.
And did you ask them to do anything for you?
No, I didn't dare to. I just talked to them and was interested in them, and they were not very communicative to me because, you see, I seemed to them to be a very young fellow from a far-off country, and so they were a little watchful of me.
Were you a believer or a skeptic?
Oh, a believer.
Now, the main character in your novel, The Cunning Man, is a doctor. Do you see him as a cunning man?
Well, that's what people called him because he had something of the same attitude toward his work. And although he was a properly trained and indeed very highly trained medical doctor, he did certain things which were not strictly orthodox medicine. And consequently, people sometimes playfully and sometimes rather sneeringly called him the cunning man because, you know, he was dealing in things which weren't strictly orthodox medicine.
There's a brief passage I'd like you to read from The Cunning Man about how this doctor sees himself as a doctor, his approach to practicing medicine.
I believe, as I discovered Paracelsus had believed before me, that there are as many stomachs, hearts, livers, and lights as there are members of the human race, and that they should be treated individually to suit their special needs, whatever these might be. And those needs are not always to be found in the laboratory, but in the lay confessional of the physician's consulting room. Treatment must be intensely personal. And if sometimes it strays into the realm of mind, there the physician must follow it. But usually it is in that realm where mind and body mingle, where the mind affects the body and the body the mind, and where untangling the relationship is the devil's own work and takes time and application and sympathy, that the hard-driven general practitioner and his specialist brother cannot be expected to provide for every patient who knocks on his door. I suppose if I were driven to describe my method of work, I would call it a type of psychosomatic medicine by which I attempted to bring about change in the disease syndromes through language and therefore through reason. And sometimes, and this is where the canker gnawed for many of my ultra-reasonable colleagues, in that fibrous darkness below reason. The change might never be complete, but the patient would feel much better because he, perhaps more often she, had learned to approach the individual quality of life and the body through which life was experienced in a different way. No, not psychoanalysis. That marvelous but extremely limited adventure in human understanding behaves as if its patients lived principally in the mind, and as if the patient's coughs and colds and indigestions, arthritis, bad lower back, tricky heart, asthma, skin ailments, and all the rest of their disquiets were creatures of another realm to be dealt with by somebody else.
That's Robertson Davies reading from his new novel, The Cunning Man, and I think that our listeners won't be surprised to hear that at one time in your career you were an actor. You read that really well.
Thank you.
Is this your idea of what a doctor should be?
It's an idea, my idea of what an ideal doctor might be, and I've only known one or two who came anywhere near the mark. Because, you see, it is so extraordinarily expensive if you're going to spend 2 hours with a patient instead of 10 minutes. And most doctors can't afford that sort of thing.
Now, why are you particularly interested in doctors?
Well, I suppose everybody's interested in doctors, but I'm interested in an enormous variety of things. And I've always been interested in professional attitudes, lawyers, doctors, clergymen, all that sort of person. And it seems to me that doctors very often are chained by a rather rigid professional attitude, which rules out a number of things which you might like them to pay attention to if they were doctoring you.
Such as?
Well, your state of mind, your feelings about life, your feelings about what life had brought to you and what you had brought to life. Because I think that these lie at the root of an awful lot of trouble, which manifests itself sometimes in ill health of one kind and another. I think you know that Thoreau was right when he said that an extraordinary number of people lived lives that were crippled by despair. And a great many people, really deep in their hearts, are rather despairing. They feel that life hasn't done right by them, that they've somehow or other had a raw deal. And although on the surface they may seem to be fortunate, deep down they feel that something is wanting. And they crave that thing, whatever it may be, passionately. And if the craving is not fulfilled, it might manifest itself in a disease of some kind.
Now, are you speaking of yourself at all here, or just about other people?
Oh, me and everybody else, yes.
Have you had a lot of reason to see doctors over the years? Have you had health problems?
Oh, yes, I have. And some of them were rather annoying, and some of them were farcical, and some of them were extremely disagreeable.
Would you mention any?
Yes, certainly. I wouldn't mind. I was telling that when I was about 35... I became rather unwell. I had shortness of breath and felt under the weather and generally not very good. And so I went to see my doctor, thinking that I just probably needed a tonic or something. But he was a very modern doctor with all the latest sort of ideas. And he x-rayed me a lot and discovered that I had some things inside me which he didn't like the look of. And he decided that I had a very ugly form of cancer, Hodgkin's disease. It's cancer of the lymphatic system. And he sent me to a specialist, and the specialist nodded his head and said, yes, oh, indeed, that's what it is. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, it's not very good. And I said, is it fatal? He said, well, yes, it can be. I said, how soon? Well, he said it could be a few months. Or, you know, we've got patients we've kept going for 17 years. And I thought, oh, thank you very much. What fun to be kept going for 17 years. And I was very, very bothered by this. And they gave me very extensive ray treatment for it, because in those days, heavy ray treatment was all the thing.
This was 46 years ago.
Yes, and I felt like a whipped dog for about 18 months. And then, you know, I didn't show any further symptoms. I seem to be all right, contrary to all medical decency. And they had the bare face to say, well, it must have been a misdiagnosis.
Do you think they really misdiagnosed you, or do you think you just made one of those unusual recoveries?
Well, now there, I cannot tell you, but you see, I'll tell you something. When I was told that I had this dreadful thing, and that it was a killer, I thought, this is utterly out of the question. I cannot afford to die. I have a wife and two small children. I have people dependent on me. It's just not on the books that I could die. I haven't the time or the I haven't got what it takes to do that. I've got to keep going. And I did. But whether that was a recovery because of something that I thought or because of the doctors having made a mistake, I don't know. But they never admitted they'd made a mistake till long after I had finished that wretched treatment.
The doctor in your novel was, as you put it, severely bitten by the bug of psychoanalysis and read everything he could find out about it. For several years, he was under its spell. And that's Freudian psychoanalysis.
Yes.
Early on. Were you ever under the spell of Freudian analysis?
Oh, yes, indeed I was. You see, when I first went to the university, we had a marvelous professor of psychology who introduced his students to Freudian ideas. And they were intensely interesting, and they're very, very interesting to young people because they seem to explain everything, and they explain everything in a rather gloomy, downbeat way. And young people love gloom because they can afford gloom. They're young enough and healthy enough to be able to put up with that attitude toward life. But as I grew older, I didn't become disillusioned with Dr. Freud's ideas, but I began to have my own reservations about them, particularly about his notions of sex being, vital to virtually every human thing. And so I rather got over Freud and began to be deeply interested in C.G. Jung, whom I found a much more humanistic and, for a writer, a much more literary person in his consideration of the human spirit.
Well, how do you think Jung influenced you as a writer?
Oh, enormously, because I know this sounds incredibly pompous and grandiose, but I found that Jung confirmed a lot of things which I had thought myself, but which I hadn't got any sort of care, medical or scientific backing for. And so I was perfectly delighted with him and went on and followed his reading with the keenest interest for years and years and years, and indeed do so still.
We're featuring an interview from earlier this year with Robertson Davies. He died last Saturday at the age of 82. We'll hear more of this interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with our interview with writer Robertson Davies. As a young man, after college, I suppose, you went to England and had a brief career there as an actor. What drew you to acting and why did you leave the profession?
Well, I loved acting and I wanted to be an actor and would probably have been one, except that the 1939 war broke out and immediately a rule was made or a law was passed in England where I was working that all theatres were to be closed because there were to be no places where large numbers of people were to assemble because of bombing. And so I woke up one morning, and in London there were about 5,000 people, 5,000 actors out of work, and I think I was number 4999. And so I had to get a living somehow or other, and so I turned back to the family trade, which is journalism.
So you went back to Canada?
Yes.
And started writing?
Yes, you see, in England they didn't want people around who didn't have to be there. And so I got out and went back to Canada and was able to get a job in journalism and did.
Now, you've said that you don't think you started writing important fiction until after your parents were dead because you were too inhibited. There were things you couldn't say while they were alive. What were your fears about how your writing could have affected your parents?
Well, it would have embarrassed them in some ways, I think. because of my attitudes towards a great many things, including sex. And so I didn't want to distress them, and I didn't write about that kind of thing in the way that I eventually did until after they were no longer there.
Did you ever feel that, well, your writing was important enough to justify any discomfort that it caused your parents?
No. I had the greatest respect for my parents and didn't wish to give them pain. And I wouldn't have done it, and I didn't do it. And I knew that I could just wait, and then the time would come.
We actually waited a long time. Your father lived to be 95.
No, he didn't live to be 95.
Oh,
he lived to be 87.
Oh, 87. I'm sorry. I don't know where I read that.
Well, I know it's spread around a lot as though he had lived to be like Methuselah, but he didn't.
So,
he was a mere lad of 87 when he died.
Uh-huh. So how did your writing change after that?
I wrote with much greater freedom and was able to say what I thought and why I thought it and how I thought it.
Robertson Davies is my guest. I want to quote something that you've said about a Jungian viewpoint. This is one of the lectures that you delivered. And you wrote, Jungians say that in the first part of a life, it's man's chief aim to be personal and social. Find your work. Find out what kind of sex life you will lead. Achieve some place in the world. Then after you've achieved those ends, your attention turns to matters that are broader in scope and often more disturbing to contemplate. Physical strength is waning, and you realize someday you're going to die, and that the way you approach death has some importance to you. This change doesn't make you an old man. What would is a frightened clinging to the values of the first part of your life. Do you feel that you went through this type of change?
Oh, very decidedly, yes.
Can you put your finger on when it was?
Oh, when I was about 40 to 45, that sort of thing.
What changed?
Well, what changed is exactly what I talked about in what you were quoting. I had found my profession. I had found my place in it, what I had to do, what my responsibilities were. I was married. I had a home, and I had children to take care of. All that sort of thing was in order and was capable of being dealt with, you see. But then I had other things, personal things to deal with, of a deeply personal kind, religious attitudes, attitudes towards the broader and more important aspects of life, all that sort of thing. And I had to come to terms with those and make up my mind about them.
Well, you write in the quote, what would make you an old man is a frightened clinging to the values of the first part of your life. Was it hard to change? Was it hard to give up certain values?
No, not for me. But I know for many people it is. Many men particularly, and I suppose it's the same for women, but I can't pretend to speak for them, but many men cling to youthful strength, youthful physical ability, youthful attitude towards sex, trying to make themselves attractive to women. All that sort of thing that young men do, and sort of aggressive and perhaps slightly boastful attitude toward life.
How many years have you been married?
55.
It's a long time.
Yes, it's a good while.
And from your writing, it really seems to me that you think that marriage for you has really been just central to every part of your life, including writing.
That is true. I don't think that's necessarily so for everybody. I've been lucky. It has been true for me.
What's the next project you plan on taking on?
Oh, I am writing all the time. I'm very busy at that sort of thing. And I expect I shall be like Bernard Shaw and be writing when I'm an old, old, old man.
Are you starting another novel?
I may do so before too long. I haven't started one yet. I'm making notes.
So you're not sure what the next book will be?
Oh, no, and I wouldn't tell you if I did.
It's no good to talk about it while it's happening?
No, it's very unlucky.
Okay.
And I'm intensely superstitious. That's one of the things I include under religion.
Superstition?
Yes.
What's the connection?
Well, obviously, it's omens and foreseeings and that sort of thing. I feel that these things all have a place in religion. I get awfully tired of people who want to exclude all that sort of thing and brush it aside as though it were unworthy of a decent mind. You've got to have a place in your mind for all sorts of irrationalities if you're going to get your ideas straight about life.
What else are you superstitious about?
Omens, things, so forth. One of the most intelligent men I ever knew was a scientist. When he went out of his house in the morning, he lived in Italy, if he saw a nun or a priest passing his doorstep, he went back inside his house and stayed there for the rest of the day because that meant it was an unlucky day. And this was a man who spent his life doing scientific experiments.
Would you ever do that?
Well, not perhaps as determinedly as that, but I keep a watchful eye out for things that might just not be good, you know.
What are those things? What are the bad omens?
Oh, I couldn't tell you right now, but perhaps when I step out of the studio, I'll meet something that I don't know what it might be.
Well, keep a watchful eye.
I will, yes.
Robertson Davies, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you very much indeed. Robertson Davies recorded earlier this year after the publication of his novel, The Cunning Man. Davies died last weekend at the age of 82. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.